On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we discuss the latest news in the industry, celebrate Labor Day with a focus segment on human resources, labor law, rest periods, and meal requirements, and discuss MRSA.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a bi-weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource the regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys. Welcome to episode 34 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for Monday, September 3rd, 2018. Recording from our studio in Rochester, New York, this is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS. I'm here with John Gailey, the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, published through Eden Group Development, a nationally known speaker on all aspects of the industry, and the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, which provides regulatory oversight services to ambulatory surgery centers throughout the United States. We are back from a short vacation to Hilton Head, where we just relaxed
and did nothing but
lived
swim
in the pool.
It was very hot there.
Yeah, but it was so nice.
It was, and our staff learned that the cell phones were not with us in the pool, so they couldn't disturb us, but we still got quite a bit of work done during the week. We never really have a vacation when you're on your own business.
But. No, but it was kind of nice that there wasn't really good reception there.
That's so right. Those conference calls never really came off.
So happy Labor Day to everybody. We have a special segment on human resources today.
Yeah, I thought it would be a good way to celebrate Labor Day to talk about labor issues. And human resources seems to be one of those topics that really administrators probably don't get enough training on. So we thought we would delve into that topic today.
Yep. And John, you've been working on an article for our friends at Outpatient Surgery Magazine called Unlock Your Equipment's Hidden Expiration Date, knowing years in advance when you'll need to replace big ticket items.
No, it sounds exciting, doesn't it? It is. It's a great article. It ended up, you know, I was working with the editors over there, and they want me to do a periodic segment on various issues here. And the first one we picked was equipment. So when we got into it, the person that was working with me, she really got very excited about it, much more so than perhaps I was with the topic, because I deal with it all the time. But she really felt that the readers would enjoy a simpler way of looking at equipment budgeting. So it's going to be in the September issue of Outpatient Surgery Magazine. It talks about how to develop a capital budget and how to plan for big purchases. And there's going to be an example spreadsheet that you can use to prepare a budget. So if you're interested, go to outpatientsurgery.net.
Okay. Okay. And we're excited about traveling to the California State Association Conference.
Yep. I've been working with the staff out there at CASA, and we have a room that we're going to be using for doing our podcast, and we're going to have a number of speakers. So we're going to do a special episode on the California State Association with members of the board of directors there and the executive director. We're also going to interview some of the speakers there.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it. There's a lot of great people we're going to talk to. The keynote speaker is Mark Eaton, an NBA All-Star. He will be talking about the four commitments of a winning and safe team.
Right, and I love the next one. Am I running an ambulatory surgery center or a nuclear power plant? High reliability principles come to healthcare, and that's by William Eisenberg. He's an MD, PhD, and he's actually agreed to an interview for a future episode of ours, so can't wait to hear what he has to say.
And then we have Ridley Barron, who it's a pretty tragic story, but I've heard he's a wonderful speaker. I think the name of his talk is Every Half Second Counts. It's about patient safety. He actually lost his wife in a car accident And then his 17-year-old son was injured, and then he lost him due to a medical error in the hospital. And he's agreed to an interview for a future episode as well.
Absolutely. I've heard him speak before. He is great. And it's a heart-wrenching story, but at the same time, it's just great information and a great lesson for all of us.
And then Michelle George, RN, MSN, CASC, has also agreed to an interview. She will be talking about transparency and patient outcomes in the ASC industry.
We're looking forward to at least the three that have already agreed to speak to us. And then we're still trying to get some other speakers to be interviewed and included in future episodes. And of course, the entire conference is just really great. I've been there several times before. Okay, let's take a break and we'll be back with our focus segment on labor law.
John, we know that our employees are the lifeblood of our ASCs and that proper management of employees is vital to the success of the operations. Given that it's Labor Day, we decided to focus on human resources today.
And this tends to be an area of weakness for many administrators and nurse managers, despite its critical nature. What we find is that very few administrators and nurse managers actually have a lot of training in employee management and human resources. And sometimes they don't even know the law in that area. So I think we also probably as an industry don't do a great job at our conferences of having a lot of materials or a lot of information or sessions on human resources. We are trying to fix that now, but it is a process that's going to take a while. And one of the things that I feel we can do with this podcast is probably start picking up on that weakness and seeing if we can provide more information on it. Mm-hmm. So let's start by referring back to the regulations, as we always do. And this comes down to the condition for coverage 416.41, governing body and management. The ASC must have a governing body that assumes full legal responsibility for determining, implementing, and monitoring policies governing the ASC's total operation. The governing body has oversight and accountability for the Quality Assessment and Performance Improvement Program, ensures that the facility's policies and programs are administered so as to provide quality health care in a safe environment, and develops and maintains a disaster preparedness plan. Now, the key words here are full legal responsibility for monitoring policies and ensures that the facility's policies and programs are administered to provide quality care. Management of the employee's personnel, of course, are a major part of carrying out those duties. Now, while the governing body is responsible for setting policy and ensuring it's carried out, the administrator is appointed by the board to carry it out. And when I refer to the administrator here, I'm also referring to like the nurse manager in many cases, because many organizations, sometimes they don't always have the title administrator there, or sometimes that nurse manager is indeed the highest ranked employee that is interacting with the employees on a day-to-day basis.
So let's talk about the administrator's role in managing human resources. I'm just going to go down a list, and John, maybe you can add some comments. So they work with attorneys to monitor federal laws and state laws and assure policies comply with those.
Right. So always monitoring the policies that you have in your organization, making sure that somebody other than you as the administrator or nurse manager is monitoring and understands the legal ramifications of any policies that you have in place. And by the way, we mentioned federal and state. We probably should mention local because there's been a lot of movement lately, especially on the West Coast, with regard to local laws taking precedence or having stricter requirements than the federal and state. And as we know, when a local law or state law is stricter than the federal laws, then the local law will prevail.
Yep. You always follow the most stringent policy. Right. And they must maintain and modify written personnel policies.
So again, the administrator really has to be on top of those policies. Now, usually those personnel policies are in the form of an employee handbook.
They carry out the disciplinary and termination process, which I know can be very difficult for a lot of people.
No, it's certainly not one of those things that most of us ever want to have to deal with. And I remember as an administrator, this is the role that I liked the least.
Yeah.
And also, it's fraught with legal problems. So carrying out the termination and disciplinary process and also working with the lawyers, again, is important.
Yeah, just to make sure you're covering all your bases and doing it appropriately. They should maintain the employee handbook. It needs to be specific to your state.
Right. And this is something I found recently is that I guess there are employee handbooks that you can download from the internet. I highly recommend you do not do that, that it really needs to be specific to your state. And again, local. And to your organization, clearly, and to the healthcare field and to the ambulatory surgery center field. So you can get yourself into a lot of trouble if you're using a standard employee handbook.
And they must develop and maintain employee grievance procedure.
So there needs to be something in place to assure that employees have a voice in what's going on and that they know who to voice any grievances or any complaints that they might have.
Maintaining the employee personnel records is another role.
Right. And we're going to talk about that at the end of this segment where we're going to talk about what's included in a personnel record.
Okay. And lastly, maintain up-to-date job descriptions.
Which nobody likes doing, but it is absolutely critical making sure that those job descriptions are specific enough to indicate what needs to be done and generic enough to make sure that we don't leave anything out that absolutely has to be done.
Okay. So how do you find out about the labor law?
So the wonderful news here is that the U.S. Department of Labor website has a wealth of information, and that's at www.dol.gov. And you're going to find many guides on how to comply. There's going to be information about probably the most major rules that apply to employees, which is the Fair Labor Standards Act, or the FLSA. Find out about the other major act, which is the Family Medical Leave Act. Has information about safety and health regulations, for example, that's where the OSHA information is. Information about non-discrimination policies. And I guess I need to finish this by again repeating the importance of having a good lawyer engaged so that you know you can call them on a moment's notice with any labor issues. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the FLSA or the Fair Labor Standards Act. And the Fair Labor Standards Act has information or has regulations about what the minimum wage is, about overtime or about record-keeping requirements, child labor standards, exemptions from the FLSA, and record keeping. So starting with minimum wage, the minimum wage is set by the federal government, but quite frankly, most of the states or many of the states now have wages that override the federal number, often simply because the cost of living in communities throughout the United States are so different that there has to be different minimum wages throughout. So it has regulations about overtime pay, and overtime pay, the federal overtime provisions are contained in the FLSA, which unless exempt, employees covered by the act must receive overtime pay for hours worked over 40 in a work week at a rate not less than time and a half their regular rates of pay. And we should note here that many states have regulations that are different than that. And probably one of the things that tends to be confusing here is whether you work more than 8 hours in a day or more than 40 hours in a week. So make sure you check your state laws to know what are the standards there. And I'll tell you, many organizations have set their own requirements. It might, you know, so they might have a situation where they'll pay overtime beyond 8 hours in one day. And that is up to you from a federal standpoint, unless the state tells you differently. The FLSA also has record keeping requirements. Again, we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but basically requires you to maintain a lot of information about employees. Child labor standards, which you might think might not apply to you, but you are prohibited from hiring minors under 16 during school hours. We never have really allowed anybody under the age of 16 to work in our organizations, but I have had summer interns come in. It's a good way of learning about, you know, how an ambulatory surgery and healthcare works. And my own daughter, Jenna, who's been on the podcast before, she was a summer intern when she was in high school during the summertime. And that's how she decided she wanted to become a nurse. So I think that's a fantastic program. There are exemptions to the FLSA for certain classes of employees, and those include managerial employees, administrative employees, and other professionals, for example, registered nurses. Now, you need to read the requirements here very carefully. There are strict requirements for these classes, so you know, make sure, again, that you work with a lawyer on this if you have any questions, and then definitely read through that. And part of your record keeping includes full information about the hours worked each week. And this includes not only exempted employees, but those that are covered under FLSA. So, Sue, probably the most often asked questions in ambulatory surgery centers is about rest periods and meal breaks. And you as a nurse probably know the importance of having a rest period and a meal break, and certainly all of our listeners do. So let's state what the federal law is, which might surprise people. So while there are no requirements for rest periods in the federal law, the law does state, and this is in 785.18 for the federal code, that rest periods of short duration running from 5 minutes to about 20 minutes are common in industry. They promote the efficiency of the employee and are customarily paid for as working time. They must be counted as hours worked. Compensable times of rest periods may not be offset against other working time, such as compensable waiting time or on-call time. Now, again, that's important to understand. I think a lot of people think that there are required rest periods, and there might be in some state laws, but the federal law itself does not require breaks, basically.
Yeah, I know that was surprising to me. I think it's important to allow that for employees, because sometimes you just need, you know, need a minute to
right
just gather yourself.
I would look at this as basically telling us we have a lot of flexibility in this area. Mm-hmm. So I would never tell people, well, the federal law doesn't require it, so you shouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I would certainly state that because there is no requirement here, it gives you a lot of flexibility in doing that. If mm-hmm. you want to give somebody a 30-minute break because they have worked, you know, for a very long time or a very intensive case, you certainly have the ability to do that and, you know, maybe hold off on those employees that haven't really, you know, had a very stressful period. I don't know. I don't want to pass judgment on mm-hmm. what is stressful is versus non-stressful. But yeah. again, flexibility is important here. Meal breaks. Also, the federal labor law 7885.19 on meals says bona fide meal periods are not work time. Bona fide meal periods do not include coffee breaks or time for snacks. These are rest periods, and the employee must be completely removed from duty for the purposes of eating regular meals. Ordinarily, 30 minutes or more is long enough for a bona fide meal period. A shorter period may be long enough under special circumstances. The employee is not relieved if he is required to perform any duties, whether active or inactive, while eating.
And I think as a nurse, it's well known that it's very difficult to get that time.
I know. I've talked about this a lot over time because when you're working in the hospital, mm-hmm. I don't know that you were ever allowed to be inactive during that period of time. You still mm-hmm. had to take care of those nurses.
Yeah, or we were told to be, but right. in reality, it's very difficult.
I think this is an area of a lot of litigation now and mm-hmm. Lawsuits and a lot of heavy penalties. So I would be very, very, very careful about how you mm-hmm. implement this. Now, the state laws here kick in quite a bit. So it's important to check your state laws. Now, I'm not aware of any state that requires you to pay for a lunch break, but many states, including California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Illinois, Kentucky, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, New York, North Dakota, Oregon, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Vermont, Washington, and West Virginia have implemented state-specific laws that outline what a reasonable lunch break entails. Now, that's a mm-hmm. list as of the most recent I was able to find. I can't guarantee that that's all-inclusive. Mm-hmm. Since about 25% of our listeners are from New York and California, here are the requirements for those states. And I'll state that many of the other states do tend to have that have a requirement here also has something very similar. Mm-hmm. So in California, half an hour meal period after 5 hours of work, unless the workday will be completed in 6 hours or less, and the employee and the employer have an agreement to waive the meal period. In New York, which we know very well because we work in New York requires non-factory workers half an hour after 6 consecutive hours, and that break needs to be taken between 11 o'clock and 2 p.m. For those whose days start before 11 a.m. and continues after 7 p.m., an additional 20 minutes is required between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. Now, interestingly, Sue, when I was reading these things, I knew about the six-hour requirement. I didn't realize mm-hmm. that there was a time frame, like a three-hour time frame included there. And I know over the years, we've probably had people that have taken that lunch break after 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I wasn't aware of that. I knew the 6 hours, as you said. I wasn't aware of that. And I think it's important to a lot of people, if they work just over 6 hours, they may say, well, you know, maybe if I just leave a half an hour early or something, and that's not...
That is not allowed at all.
Even if you both agree to it, that's not something that can be done.
So now everybody has the regulations there, and hopefully you'll, again, consult with a lawyer if you've had any problems in the past or you're confused about this. Definitely go to the Department of Labor website to get more information. Go to your state website for the requirements in your state. So let's talk about Family Medical Leave Act.
The FMLA entitles eligible employees of covered employers to take unpaid job-protected leave for specified family and medical reasons with continuation of group health insurance coverage under the same terms and conditions as if the employee had not taken leave.
So the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, or FMLA, requires employers to maintain those group insurance benefits for anybody that takes the FMLA. And employers who require employees to pay some portion of their health insurance premiums can continue to require employees to pay while they're off of work. Now, this can be quite burdensome for smaller organizations, as you can imagine, mm-hmm. especially in those states where the employer is paying a significant portion of the employee's health insurance. So
the FMLA applies to all ASCs with 50 or more employees.
So that does help a little bit. So it mm-hmm. tends to be those larger organizations.
Yeah. Those employers must provide an eligible employee with up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave each year for any of the following reasons. for the birth and care of the newborn child of an employee, for placement with the employee of a child for adoption or foster care, to care for an immediate family member, spouse, child, or parent with a serious health condition, or to take medical leave when the employee themselves is unable to work because of a serious health condition.
And employees are eligible for a leave if they have worked for the employer at least 12 months and at least 1,250 hours over the past 12 months. So let's talk about employment at will. This is one of those areas that often is used as a way to get rid of employees that have not been performing very well. And it technically means that an employer may terminate an employee at any time without cause, notice, or penalty. Now, because this tends to be one of those areas that is heavily litigated, many states are actually moving away from this concept of employment at will. And it still is very important to fully document the reason for the termination to avoid discrimination claims. And in our notes here, I have lawyer in big capital letters again. So I was on the phone constantly with our employment lawyer, you know, when I was running. Luckily, I don't have those problems with this company, but when I was running an ambulatory surgery center, there was always a lot of issues that we had to deal with, unfortunately. And
so is that a different category of employment? Like you hire somebody in a different way, or does that kind of apply to everybody?
Yeah, no, there are quite a number of lawyers that really focus on employment law specifically. And I don't think we have it in our notes here to talk about, but I should mention that there are policies, insurance policies that you can get that can help protect you for employment practices. So definitely look into it. Maybe I'll include that in a future segment or research that a little bit more. I know we have it as part of a regular package of insurance coverage, but I quite frankly don't know a heck of a lot about it. So we'll have to learn about that for a future episode.
So let's talk about employee discipline. So we often have policies for progressive discipline, but note that it's not required unless the employee is part of a union contract or has an employment contract that establishes grounds for termination.
So again, we need to point out here that most employees are employed in a state that has employment at will under an employment at will statute, which means that there is no contract, there's no obligation to continue employment. Those exceptions in those states that do have employment at will are when you have a union contract or when you have an employment contract that establishes the grounds for termination. So most attorneys will tell you to try to avoid employment contracts because that can really provide limitations on what you can do with an underperforming employee.
So making sure any policy that you have allows you to escalate or terminate without using the progressive system if the situation comes up that you need to do that.
Right. And this is especially important when an employee does something that's really egregious or, you know, life-threatening, is that you don't want to have to, at that point where you realize that this employee really is not in the right field, not in the right company.
Yeah, especially with healthcare. I would think, you know, there's times when if you don't feel safe with that employee, you just can't take any chances.
Yeah. So I think that the point being here is that have a progressive discipline policy, but make sure that it includes the ability for you to escalate that or not use it if the situation warrants. And document, document, document. Mm-hmm. You talk about it in medical records. We talk about it in all aspects of everything we do in regulatory area, document everything, even verbal warning. The term verbal only means that you talked to the employee and didn't give them a piece of paper, but you still should be documenting all of those verbal warnings that you're giving to them. And be consistent and fair. So don't show favoritism for any employees because the other employees will see this. This is often one of those things that we find we're doing without really noting it, is that we treat people that we like or that we know well or that help us out in difficult times better than we perhaps treat those that are a little bit more argumentative. And we have to be consistent and fair and treat everybody the same because employees will see that. And this tends to be one of those things that leads to job dissatisfaction. So let's jump into what an employee file looks like. So a lot of this is kind of obvious, but probably a good thing to point out anyway. You should have a job application and a CV and or a CV, but a job application should at least set all of those things that you want to prove. So a job application is going to have certain requirements, such as you know, questions about whether they've been convicted of a felony, et cetera. So it's important that that job application and that signature that denotes that they've given you all this information is accurate. They have to have the documentation of the interview with the employee, the initial interview. References. You need to check them before hiring. So I have a story here, you know, back, and this was 30 years ago, a nurse manager that I was working with came into my office after an interview and said, John, I think I made a mistake. And I said, oh no, what's going on? And she said that she just hired this guy on the spot. She really liked him. Mm-hmm. And then she checked the reference. And the first person she spoke to, who happened to be a friend of hers, said, oh, my God, do not hire him. He is absolutely horrible. And she was just, you know, she learned her lesson very quickly there, mm-hmm. that even, you know, when you get a good feeling about somebody, you really need to check those references. Now, of course, this was 30 years ago when people tended to be a little bit more open.
Yeah, a little more trusting.
Yeah.
But, nowadays, you know, some people are just, they're good at interviews.
Right. You know, today, even checking references, unfortunately, is not always going to be helpful. Luckily, mm-hmm. you know, we kind of know those code words to watch out for, but definitely check those references before hiring. You might be surprised at what you find.
Yeah, because they really can't say too much, right? When you're speaking to somebody, they can say how long they were there. They can.
There's no law that's really stopping you from doing that. The problem with that is that you tend to get sued by people who have had you know, bad experiences with another employer, and that employer, you know, kind of badmouths them in the future. So that's why people are very careful about what they release during a reference check. So
maybe if there's just very minimal information, like you said, kind of those code things, you get that feeling like they really, you know, aren't recommending them. They just aren't saying anything wrong.
Right, exactly. We need to verify their licenses and other requirements that you might have, for example, ACLS, as well as get copies of those licenses. File should contain periodic performance evaluations and competencies for clinical employees.
Now, do you do that every year?
So that's a great question because, frankly, the word periodic is used throughout accreditation standards, and performance evaluations do not generally have to be done every year unless your policy states that.
Okay.
I highly recommend people do not put a requirement for annual performance evaluations, even if you tend to do them, simply because we tend to, I myself always was falling behind in performance evaluations because we always had something else that seemed to be much more pressing to do.
I think that's really a good point, too, because, and that's something we've mentioned in other contexts, but, you know, regardless of whatever the regulations are, if you put it in your policy, you have to do it.
So that's right.
You can always do over and above your policy, but once you put it in writing, you have to, you're held to that.
That's right. That's right. And as we've talked about in other podcasts in the past, you need to probably be focusing a little bit more on competencies for clinical employees than performance evaluations themselves. We need to have information about the benefits that the employee signed up for, information about their salary, and then there's certain government-required forms, the W-4 and the I-9. Now, this is something, Sue, that I've been finding lately. Note the date on the I-9. The I-9 actually has an expiration date, and you need to be using an I-9 that is dated, that expires after the date that the form was completed, and then the I-9s need to be kept in a separate file. Now, interestingly, in, I would say, the last 3 to 4 months, every single center that I have visited has had an issue with the I-9s because they tend to take that blank form and use it forever without realizing there's an expiration date on it. So we fixed that certainly in our clients. I have, you know, done some surveys for people and kind of pointed out the importance of making sure they have the most recent I-9. And of course, now with the focus on immigration, this is even more important. Should be doing an inquiry of the OIG to make sure that they have not been banned from the Medicare program. I always recommend that your job description should be signed, and I think that's a very good thing to have in your record. An acknowledgement that they've been given their personnel policies and procedures, usually, and hopefully that's an employee handbook. Any background checks, for example, in some states you have to do a criminal background check. Information about emergency contacts, documentation of training, including the orientation.
Yeah, but that should be ongoing.
Absolutely. Yes. This is what tends to make those files pretty thick. Information about any disciplinary actions, and a separate file that includes health information. Sue, why don't you talk about that health information?
Okay, you need the evidence of PPD testing, vaccinations, including Hep B, MMR, varicella, and tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. With the flu vaccinations, once we enter flu season, you have to, if you have not gotten the flu vaccine, you have to wear a mask when you're around patients and others.
That's a New York State requirement, but other states are starting to pick up on that. And it's really, I mean, certainly I think that's a very good thing to do. We should point out here that the flu issue is going to be interesting because remember, the proposed 2019 regulations no longer require us to report to NHSN on flu vaccinations in the organizations. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing them. It just means that we don't have to report on it. So it'd be interesting to see what happens in the industry as that requirement is taken away. But needless to say, Vaccinating for the flu is an important element of your risk management program to assure that you're not spreading the flu throughout your patient population.
Yep, and document any injuries.
That's right. For an OSHA requirement, if you have needle sticks or any other types of injuries, document that and show the full health history on that. Okay, so let's take a short break, and then we'll come back with a short discussion of MRSA and talk about upcoming events.
So, John, there is a lot going on with ambulatory healthcare strategies. Can you give our listeners an update on the company and its services?
Sure. Well, as you well know, we are growing fast. We now have 10 employees. You were number 9. We've since hired another summer intern, though I guess it's going to be a fall intern, actually, now. All of our employees are scattered throughout the East Coast with a cadre of independent consultants that we call upon when we need them. And probably one of the most exciting news that we've had recently is Alex Borneman, our director of operations and our go-to guy for life safety issues, passed his NFPA certification and became a CLSS-HC, which stands for Certified Life Safety Specialist for Healthcare. So we're now offering life safety surveys, which is something somewhat new to us, and they're included in all of our retainers.
So what is a retainer?
So the core of our business is really retainer-based services. While we regularly help centers out with mock surveys, survey preparation, and post-survey mitigation, the core of what we do is make sure that you don't have to prepare for a survey or deal with the complex post-survey plans of correction. To that end, we have a regulatory compliance retainer, which is basically a way for centers to outsource quality improvement, risk management, infection control, emergency preparedness, and other CMS and accreditation oversight services.
And what is included in that retainer?
While all of our services can be tailored to the exact needs of the organization, our standard retainer includes either monthly or quarterly visits to the center, review of all quality improvement, risk management, infection control, and emergency services activities and documentation, preparation for attendance at and preparation of the minutes for the quality improvement meeting, the medical executive meeting, and the governing body meetings. Annual updates to the policy and procedure manual to comply with state CMS and accreditation requirements. We also prepare educational programs for orientation and annual mandatory education, and we can actually do those educational programs too if you wish. And of course, 24/7 access to me and my incredible staff for issues that might come up.
Well, that sounds expensive.
Well, I think the price might surprise many of our listeners. But the way you have to look at it is this: how can you afford not to? Many of our centers simply cannot afford or cannot find an administrator that has all of the education, training, and experience to handle quality improvement, risk management, emergency services, and infection control. And our service allows centers to hire good MRSA managers that can focus on those things that they're best trained for, and we handle the rest.
So how do our listeners learn more about this?
Well, feel free to give me a call at 585-594-1167. That's 585-594-1167, or send us an email at info@ah-strategies.com. That's info@ahhealthcare-strategies.com.
So, John, we've had some concerns from our centers about patients who may come in with existing infections, such as MRSA. We found a sample MRSA policy from Laser Spine Institute on Becker's ASC from back on February 11th, 2011. It outlined a policy for screening, asking about possible signs of infection, you know, in the pre-admit phone call,
right.
Requiring pre-testing if you have any concerns. If the center accepts someone with a history of MRSA, implement isolation precautions and schedule possibly as the last case of the day, and then, you know, do the terminal cleaning after that. If patient has an active infection, you may require treatment and a negative test result before accepting that patient. But one important note is that you really can't count on accurate self-reporting, and a patient may not even know that they're colonized. So the most important lesson, again, going back to strictly following universal precautions, thorough hand hygiene and environmental cleaning between patients, because, of course, it's a contact precaution.
So we actually had a situation this last week where they did a case on a patient, And they found out after the case was done mm-hmm. that the patient tested positive for MRSA. We're obviously looking into why they didn't get the results beforehand, whether mm-hmm. they expected any results. There's a lot of other questions, and this just happened.
But so I think, I don't know, and you may never find out with some patients.
Right. You know, so. But I think it's important here that if there is a possibility that somebody has MRSA, that you mm-hmm. wait at least until you get those test results. Mm-hmm. I don't know what fell apart there, but I have a lot of questions asked. It's a classic mm-hmm. quality improvement thing is what caused this to happen, and you know, what can we do potentially to avoid it in the future? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I guess you found a great tool that we can possibly give patients after surgery in this investment, not necessarily specific to MRSA, but to hand washing.
I found it again in Becker's ASC. There's a hand washing flyer that some of the centers send home with patients on their discharge. It gives clear instructions on effective hand washing, like what you'll see in the hospital or any of us healthcare workers, about really getting front, back, under your nails, how long to hand wash, and encourages patients to perform hand hygiene before doing anything that can spread any kind of contaminant, before putting drops in their eyes, before touching their surgical site, you know, and that can really help prevent spreading things around once they get home. And then in Outpatient Surgery magazine, I found an article from August 2018 that had some interesting information on MRSA and other SSIs. The article stated that 30% of people are colonized with Staph aureus before they even get into the OR, and 80% of wound infections are traced to the patient's own nasal flora. So it's not always coming from the center. So that's why that hand washing can be a great tool. The article also noted that pre-surgical prep, such as having patients wash with chlorhexidine and treated with nasal mupirocine ointment are good protocols, and you know, people often do that, but the instructions may not be followed by the patient. They may not do a thorough job. So they found that swabbing the patient's nares within 2 hours of surgery with povidone iodine is a really effective, quick, and inexpensive way of doing that. It was found to be very effective. And so this one center talked about they just do it with all of their patients. I mean, it was like $14 for the povidone, and they really reduced their infection rates.
That's incredible. So again, we want to kind of give credit is due here. Becker's ASC and Outpatient Surgery Magazine provide us a lot of good information.
Yeah, great resources.
We'll provide some references to them, and hopefully everybody's going to be reading Outpatient Surgery Magazine, because I'll be in it next month anyway. So.
And that article, by the way, was Outpatient Surgery Magazine, Keep Your Nose Clean, August 2018.
And that's at outpatientsurgery.net, and the Becker's is beckersasc.com. So let's talk about, as we always do at the end of our show, the upcoming events in the ASC industry.
Hey, so as you know, every week we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the information to info@ascpodcast.com.
As we've talked about before, the California Ambulatory Surgery Association, CASA, annual conference is this coming week, September 5th through the 7th. 2018 in Huntington Beach, California. And we're going to be heading out there, as we said, to do a special episode.
Yeah, very excited about that. The ASC Association's National Advocacy Day 2018 is September 5th, 2018. For more information and to sign up to visit your congressmen and senators in Washington, D.C., visit the Ask Association website. I don't know. It's probably
a little too late since for that's going to be the day after tomorrow. But
but they usually put information up about, you know, how it went and what they did. And they'll, I'm sure, have future ones. So keep an eye out.
The Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association 2018 Annual Conference and Trade Show is September 12th through the 13th. 2018 at the Erb Memorial Union in Eugene, Oregon.
The Ohio State Association meeting will be September 18th through the 20th at the Hilton Polaris in Columbus, Ohio, and we will be there too.
We absolutely will be. The Virginia Ambulatory Surgery Association Fall Conference is at the Hilton Garden Inn, Virginia Beach, Oceanfront on September 20th. Why weren't we not invited to that?
I know.
The Oceanfront Hotel. Oh, wow.
Was thinking the same thing. The Indiana Federation of Ambulatory Surgery Centers 2018 Fall Conference and Trade Show is September 28th at the Ritz-Charles in Carmel, Indiana.
The Pennsylvania Ambulatory Surgery Association annual meeting is October 1st, 2018 at the Sheridan Harrisburg Hershey Hotel in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and we will be there.
The OR Excellence 2018, sponsored by our friends at Outpatient Surgery Magazine, is October 3rd through 5th, 2018, at the Harbor Beach Marriott Resort and Spa in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
The New York State Association of ASC's Fall Conference will be held at the Roosevelt Hotel on October 11th, 2018.
The 5th Annual New York Metro ASC Symposium, November 2nd, 2018 at the Marriott Marquis in the heart of Times Square.
The California Association of Surgery Centers Infection Prevention Seminar is November 7th and 8th, 2018 in Costa Mesa.
The 2019 ASCA Winter Seminars are January 17th to 19th in Austin, Texas at the Hilton Austin. The 2019 conference will include three tracks, the ASC Management Essentials, Coding Update, and Reimbursement Strategies and Infection Prevention Techniques in ASCs.
And I'll be speaking at that conference also. Okay. And ASCA 2019 will be at one of my favorite hotels, the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in Nashville, Tennessee, May 15th through the 18th, 2019. And I think I'll be doing three presentations there. Well, that's it for this edition of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again in 2 weeks, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the favor of hitting the subscribe button. And hopefully we'll see a bunch of you in California.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.